Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Today, on the National Mall here in Washington, D.C., thousands of readers turned out at the National Book Festival, where they met some of their favorite authors.
I actually came out here to see James Patterson, but I saw Holly Black on the list. I'm so excited to meet her.
I was trying to get to Paula Deen, but the line looks very long, so...
I'm just kind of going around. I wanted to see Kate DiCamillo, and I'm interested in hearing Jeanette Walls as well.
That was Sarah Maslach, and before her, fellow readers Ellen Hafer and Mary Brooks. I went down to check out the festival a few hours ago, and I met with a couple of children's book authors, Kate DiCamillo, who wrote The Tale of Despero, and John Sheska, creator of The Stinky Cheese Man and other Fairly Stupid Tales. John also holds the lofty title, National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Kate DiCamillo, John Sheska, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're recording this in the middle of the afternoon. Are your wrists tired from signing so many books already?
I feel pretty happy. I was thrilled for everybody that came through the line. I don't think anybody came through John's line, so his wrists are fine.
I was still happy, too, though.
He's happy no matter what happens, you know?
But it must be pretty cool to meet all the kids who read your stuff.
It's fabulous. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And really, truly, I don't know if you feel like you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, but the thrill of it never wears off.
No, it's true. It's always the same. Phenomenal. You walk out there and see hundreds, thousands of people standing in line.
Well, one of the reasons why we're talking to the both of you here today is because the Library of Congress has launched a new project that both of you are involved with. It's called The Exquisite Corpse Adventure, which is actually...
Wow, that sounds creepy.
Which is actually... It is a children's book. John Sheska, could you explain what this project is?
Yeah. The Exquisite Corpse form is actually like a story that's pieced together out of many parts. And we wanted to do something with the Library of Congress to promote the new website, read.gov. Mm-hmm. So we thought, what if we got together a mess of authors and illustrators, had them each write a piece of a story and put it all together.
Earlier today, you read from the first installment of the story, and I was wondering if you could read a portion of that story for us.
I would love to.
We have it for you.
Starting with, if the train makes it over the treacherous gorge, there's a good chance that you and Nancy and Joe will have to deal with werewolves, mad scientists, real ninjas and fake vampires, one roller skating baby, a talking pig, creatures from another planet, possibly another dimension, killer poetry, clues from classic children's books, two easy riddles, several bad knock-knock jokes, plenty of explosions, a monkey disguised as a pirate, two meatballs, a blue plastic Star Wars lunchbox, missing its matching thermos, a ticking clock, and not just one bad guy, but a whole army of villains, cads, scalawags, sneaks, rats, varmints, and swindlers.
Kate DiCamillo, how are you going to continue that story?
Best of luck.
Well, the way I've survived thus far in life is just like picking one detail and fixating on it. And I think you know what that detail is. Did you hear the meatball mentioned
again
in there?
Yep.
I took the meatball and I ran with it.
So you guys seem to know each other pretty well. And I'm wondering if there's sort of a children's book author sort of cabal who sort of secretly run the world. But in all seriousness, I mean, you know each other, and you know other children's book authors.
We do. It's actually a really wonderful community of people. Everybody just celebrates everybody else's success. Don't you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. I don't think it is like a competition.
Yeah.
And it's like people we like to hang out with. I mean, we meet each other at these events, and we have the same experiences that we share. And nobody quite understands what that is to be in a room with, you know, 500 little guys screaming and chanting. You have to talk to someone about that to make it go away.
I don't know anybody mean in this community.
I do. Should I say their names, though?
Oh, I know a couple. Yeah, go ahead and say them.
I don't think we should.
No, you're the ambassador.
Yeah, I love everyone.
That's John Sheska and Kate DiCamillo. Each has a book out this month. John's is called Robot Zot, and Kate's new one is The Magician's Elephant. You can read an excerpt from the first chapter of that Exquisite Corpse project at npr.org.
A new political effort to stop large overdraft fees could change the way Americans bank. Congressional Democrats want to end the practice of charging high penalty fees to customers who spend beyond the funds that are in their accounts. For more now, we're joined by Joan O'Sara, author of the Talking Business column in the New York Times, at the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So what are these proposed changes?
Well, that's pretty simple. they want.
That's
to
why
eliminate.
I asked you, Joe. It was a simple question, and I hope to get a straight answer. Yes.
they want to eliminate the overdraft fees on debit cards. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as recently as 10 years ago or so, there weren't any overdraft fees on debit cards. If you ran a debit card through a machine and you didn't have enough money, they just said, forget it.
Yeah.
But somebody figured out maybe a decade or so ago that it was very lucrative to, instead of doing that, to actually let the thing go through and then just charge you for the overdraft. And it began at around $10, and now it's up to around $40. And, you know, now that we're in a recession and financial crisis and all of that, you know, both Congress and the people who are being charged these fees have started to pay attention and had come to view them as pretty outrageous.
But, I mean, people shouldn't write rubber checks, right?
No, they shouldn't write rubber checks. But Scott, a lot of what's happening here is that the people who are being charged these fees are precisely the people who can afford them the least. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not something – the upper middle class is not being charged very many overdraft fees when their debit card bounces because it almost never bounces. It's the person who's living paycheck to paycheck. And so there – and also, you're not warned that – you don't have the option to opt out of it, and you're not warned that, you know, you're close to the line or you're not given an option of deciding whether to pay for it or to walk away. You just find out you have a $39 – charge on your bill. So it is, in that sense, pretty outrageous. And, you know, some banks trying to preempt any potential legislation this week decided to either lower their fees or to give people an option to opt out. And that those included the Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells. So, you know, the banks themselves kind of see the handwriting on the wall.
But are they doing this hoping to dissuade people from dissuade or deter legislation, or is it too late for that?
They are definitely doing it to deter legislation. Now, there has already been legislation passed this year, but that had to do with credit cards. And in the anger over these overdraft fees, which really were exposed by the press over the last 4 or 5 months or so, USA Today, New York Times, and 60 Minutes, mm-hmm. Now the Congress is so angry they want to move up the starting date for this legislation from sometime in 2010 to the end of 2009. So there is definitely an anti-credit card, anti-debit card movement on Capitol Hill. And you know, the banks are nervous.
Yeah. Hey, Joe, I want to switch directions totally and ask you a G20 question.
Oh, boy.
Okay. What do you think? Did they deserve all the self-congratulation they were giving each other for averting world financial crisis?
not especially. I mean, they deserve some. I mean, look, you know, England saved two banks. Germany shored up its banks. The U.S. did what they had to do to avert financial crisis. But, you know, the problem with what Dan called those nice-sounding words and sentences is everybody can say, oh, yes, we need new capital requirements in our banks and that they should be standardized across nations. But the U.S. and Europe in particular have such huge differences mm-hmm. in what they view as legitimate capital standards, which are really, really important, that, you know, they're going to be fighting about this for the next 5 years. So, you know, agreeing on principles is one thing, but agreeing on a true plan of action with real numbers behind it is something quite different.
Mm-hmm. And the lack of jobs, is that still the major problem in the world economy?
It most certainly is. It most certainly is. You know, here, Europe, you know, it's not so much a problem in China, but the Chinese know how to deal with a financial crisis. They just pour money at it.
Joe Nocera, author of the Talking Business column of the New York Times, joining us today from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Joe, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. SpongeBob SquarePants is going to take a bit of a breather today. Nickelodeon, the entertainment TV network for children, is going dark for 3 hours this afternoon, along with its website. The network wants to encourage children to log off, tune out, and just play. They're calling it the Worldwide Day of Play. For some expert insight, we're joined again by kid reporter Brennan LaBrie, founder and publisher of the Spruce Street Weekly in Port Townsend, Washington. Brennan, good to have you back.
Nice talking to you.
By the way, you are definitely back by popular demand. We had you on our show a few weeks ago when you were to be a reporter in the magazine Time for Kids and such an audience favorite. We look for chances to bring you back. So nice to join you again.
Mm-hmm.
You going to participate?
Yes, I am. And it's a really beautiful fall over here. So playing outside is going to be a lot of fun.
Now, I understand you did some reporting for us about what some of your friends are also going to be doing.
Yes, and I also interviewed a few elementary age classes.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were gasping at first. What? Because they didn't know about it. But then I just mentioned play outside, and they were all for it.
Oh, good, good. So what are some of your friends doing? Just playing outside generally?
Yes, there were a lot of bike riders in the group.
Mm-hmm.
And one boy was perfectly fine with going out and playing his Game Boy.
Playing with his Game Boy?
Yeah.
Oh, does that count?
I don't know.
Doesn't quite fit the spirit.
Doesn't quite fit, what Nickelodeon wants.
Yeah. I'm told you don't even have a television at home, right?
No, but I love to get like a collection of SpongeBob or something
mm-hmm.
and watch it on a rainy day with some hot chocolate.
I guarantee you, I've watched SpongeBob a few times with our six-year-old, and I just don't get it. He's a sponge, right?
Right. It's just nonsense.
Okay, well,
there's something so when just tired of all this stuff in the world, you can just lie back to see a world of innocence and fun.
Thank you, Brennan. That's good to know. I think we could all stand that from time to time. Now, last time we spoke with you, you were among the finalists to be a reporter for Time for Kids. How did that work out?
It's been going pretty good, and Time for Kids is getting some good assignments for me.
Can you share with us some of the story ideas, or is that like, exclusive to the Spruce Street Weekly in Time?
Hmm. Right now, I'm coming up with ideas, and the Winter Olympics is a possibility.
Yeah, Winter Olympics are in Vancouver, right?
Right. It's right across the sound,
mm-hmm.
and I'm always ready for an assignment.
Brennan, to cover the Winter Olympics at your age, would that be wonderful, huh?
That's going to be one of the high points in my life.
Oh, my gosh.
That is going to be so exciting.
Well, Brennan, I hope that all works out. May I ask again, how old are you?
I just turned 10 a few days ago.
Seriously, you're 10 years old?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I bet you get that a lot, don't you?
Uh-huh.
Brennan LaBrie, awfully nice talking to you again.
Nice talking to you, too.
Brennan LaBrie, who joined us on the phone from his home in Washington State, where he is editor, publisher, founder of the Spruce Street Weekly. Happy day of play, Brennan.
Yes.
Take care. Talk to you again, I hope.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hey, kids, play. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. High school can certainly be rough for any teenager, but try to imagine going to high school each morning knowing that you don't have health insurance. There are more than 3 million uninsured teenagers in the United States. About 75% of them qualify for public health coverage, but they're not signed up. Others come from families that earn too much to qualify for government assistance, but not enough to afford private insurance. Sarah Varney of member station KQED has the story of one California teenager who's just joined the ranks of the uninsured.
How do you tell your child they no longer have health insurance? And as a child, how do you figure out what it really means? For 15-year-old Jackie Diaz, it really hit home when her mom said she'd probably have to forfeit a spot on the varsity basketball team.
She told me that we didn't have health insurance right now, and she needed to find like one for us because school was starting, and I like to do track and basketball. So she said that might be cut back because, I mean, if I broke anything, it's a lot. Like a bone or anything, it'd be a lot to go to even the hospital or a visit to the clinic. So,
Jackie lives in Woodland, California, a small farming town near Sacramento. Her parents own a pipe welding business that had always provided health insurance, not only for the family, but for their employees as well. But earlier this year, the company could no longer afford the rising premiums for anybody. It dropped its policy, and Jackie's family became uninsured for the first time. Jackie's mom tried to sign the children up for a state health insurance program. They were put on a wait list, and there are no guarantees. That's when Jackie got word she might have to sit out basketball her junior year at Pioneer High School.
It just sucks because you have to stop a sport you like doing just because someone can't offer you because money's tight right now. Okay, so this is my room. To the right's my bed.
Track and field and basketball medals line Jackie's room. There's a coach's award for freshman basketball next to her bed and an MVP plaque for track and field next to her overstuffed closet. The walls and ceilings are painted in green and blue stripes, and Jackie's friends have put their painted handprints on the wall.
She hasn't even finished it, but it's my best friend. Her name's Julia. And then this is Cody's, my friend Tony. And then another friend, his name's Miguel, and then my
These are her best friends. Jackie tells them everything. But somehow, not having health insurance felt like a mark, something to be embarrassed about. At first, Jackie didn't think she would tell them, but then she went ahead with it anyway.
Well, we were at lunch. It was me, my friend, Julia, Thomas, Cody, Christian, Carissa, Alyssa, and we were just there, and I was like, oh, do you guys all have healthcare? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, why? And I was like, oh, no reason. And then they're like, do you not have it? And I was like, no. They're like, oh, okay. I mean, they didn't really question me anymore.
Did they ask you why you didn't have it?
No, they didn't ask me why. I think they not knew, but they like knew they shouldn't question me just because it's like, you know, none of their business or anything.
But the issue didn't go away. Instead, Jackie says, it got some of her friends wondering about their own health coverage.
I went over to a friend's house and she commented about, you know, having money, and I was like, we're tight on money right now. And then my friend Julia asked her mom if they had health insurance, and her mom was like, of course, why? And then she's like, oh, because Jackie, you know, is doing this. And then she asked me, she's like, you guys, in like a surprise way, she's like, you guys don't have health insurance? And I was like, no. And she's like, oh.
It felt like the mom was judging her, Jackie says. Or perhaps it was pity. That was a new feeling. She's always lived in a nice house. Her mom drives a shiny white Prius. She has a closet full of stylish clothes. And she's already thinking about where to apply to college. She's not used to people feeling sorry for her.
It's something that just, like, people look at you different because they're just, like, so surprised that you don't have health insurance because they see a different side of you.
Jackie says her friends are really accepting. And though she's not one for drama, she does worry about what the other kids in her small high school would think about her being uninsured. They talk bad behind your back, she says. The word will get out in November if Jackie doesn't have health insurance by then. That's when basketball season begins, and the students at Pioneer High School will want to know why one of their star players is missing. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
Our friend Will Grozier is a London cabbie by day and an avid reader. Well, Will, do you read at the stoplights?
I try to, and I get in trouble for it sometimes, Scott.
All right.
Beep, beep.
we talk to Will Grozier from time to time for his book recommendations. He joins us from London. Welcome back, Will.
Well, thank you, Scott. Good morning to you, and it's been a long time. How have you been?
Fine, thanks. How have you been?
Well, the news from London is good. Positive economic indicators. You all want to know how the economy is before we start with books, so I'm going to tell you. Mm-hmm. And that is that after a dismal beginning to the year and then a dip for summer holidays, we have come out of that with quite a rush. So it's good news.
It's good.
The indicators are good.
So what you're reading?
Well, I'm wading. I'm not even wading. I'm progressing with due diligence through the Booker-nominated Sarah Waters' The Little Stranger.
Booker Prizes are coming up, the man.
Booker Prizes are coming up on the 6th of October. Mm-hmm. And I certainly wasn't going to rise to the challenge of trying to read all six. So I stuck a pin in the tail of the donkey and came up with Sarah Waters. No, that's not strictly true. I took a view that there are three heavyweights this year and three lightweights. Mm-hmm. And being the champion of the underdog, I thought, well, let's have a look at who's nominated. And Coetzee's nominated for a third time and hasn't bothered to turn up twice for the award ceremony. So
this is the great South African, right?
The great South African, yes.
Nobel laureate, too, I believe, right?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. But there was a piece in the press here rather dismissively complaining about the fact that he can't be bothered to acknowledge. So I think if I was a committee member, I'd probably not be too enamoured with that behaviour. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, if I'm not going to read a twice winner, I'll try and read a twice nominated. And Sarah Walters has been twice nominated. So mm-hmm. I thought, well, I'll run with that. And this is a very well-crafted story of a dysfunctional family in the post-war austere era in Great Britain that gulls you into believing that you're reading a historical novel mm-hmm. until about the 100th page, when you suddenly realise that you become sucked into a suspense thriller. And I thought, oh no, not things that go bump in the night. But such is the clever crafting of the way the book is written that you have to go with it. It's the story of a little girl who comes back to haunt a family and progressively wreaks destruction on the family. And the thing that anchors it is the very staid and sensible doctor, who's a very logical man, who fights tooth and nail against all this irrationality. Very well written, thoroughly deserves its place in the listings. And I don't know, it may be one of those dark horses that just pulls it off against the odds.
Mm. One of the reasons we love talking to you, Will, in addition to your enthusiasm for what you read, is I think you read the way people who really love reading do. Something old, something new, something borrowed, something stolen from the back of the cab.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a piece of flotsam to be blown in any direction that the book cares to throw me. I mean, in another vein, particularly on that, I'm turning away from the mic, but I'll come back to you.
Yeah.
In another way, reading the shortlist for the Booker and seeing Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, mm-hmm. I then happened a couple of days later on a book of short stories by a writer that you'll probably know, Tobias Wolff.
Of course.
Yeah, and he has a compendium of his short stories called Our Story Begins. One of the things I've enjoyed about some of the stories I've read of his is the economy of the short story writer. And let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. One of the stories is a group of hunters that go out into the freezing cold wastelands of some rural state to go shooting. And there ensues some kind of discourse or argument between them. And one of them shoots the farmer's dog. The other guy gets all riled by his friend's behavior and shoots his friend. So now they heap this poor unfortunate into the back of the truck. And then the last line, this is the beautiful economy. This is the beautiful economy of the short story writer. And if I can just find it for you, you'll have to fill here for a little bit while I find it. No, right. You won't. No, you won't.
Thank you, Will.
Tubbs smiled out of the back window. Kenny lay with his arms folded over his stomach, moving his lips at the stars. Right overhead was the Big Dipper, and behind, hanging between Kenny's feet in the direction of the hospital, was the North Star, Pole Star, Help to Sailors. As the truck twisted through the gentle hills and the star went back and forth between Kenny's boots, staying always in his sight, "I'm going to hospital," Kenny said. But he was wrong. They'd taken a different turn a long way back. And that he's going to leave it hanging in the air, knowing full well the guy's never going to get to the hospital, the guy's going to expire in the back of the truck. And that's the art of the short story writer.
The short story invites you to fill in the blank.
Absolutely, yeah. He's given you clues along the way. You know from the tenor of the two protagonists in the truck that they couldn't give a rip about the guy in the back, and you know what his fate's going to be. So I think that's a little volume to be saved. And I'm following the same theme here mm-hmm. by another serendipitous purchase, Science Friction by Michael Shermer. Shermer is the editor and driving force behind The Skeptic magazine.
I'm a believer myself.
strong believer in skepticism. Yeah. And again, it doesn't take much to sell a piece or a book to me, but when I just opened the flyer and read that his great mentor in life was the essayist Stephen Jay Gould, I thought, okay, that's a steal.
Yeah. Yeah, great essayist and baseball fan, if you ever read Stephen Jay Gould on baseball.
Well, yes, and as you remember, Scott, he is credited with explaining to the Americans how cricket works, or is it the other way around? I can never remember.
A little of both, I think.
A little of both.
Well, always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
And you, sir. And you, sir.
Will Grozier, finest cabbie and reader in London, with his book recommendations, the Booker-nominated Sarah Waters novel, The Little Stranger, Tobias Wolff's short story compendium, Our Story Begins, and Science Friction by Michael Shermer.